Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
At one stage, 2 years ago, I didn't think we'd ever have today's first guest back on the show. So I'm delighted to say good morning, Salman Rushdie.
Good morning to you.
Salman, people will know that about 2 years ago, you were speaking at an event in New York and you were subject to a savage and sustained knife attack. It's probably fair to say you're lucky to be alive. Does it feel like that? Are you that cliche of the guy who walked away from the air crash, second chance, determined to appreciate life more?
Yes, I am that cliche. I'm exactly that cliche. I mean, it really was against the odds that I would survive. And actually, even the surgeons who had to operate on me feared that it might be too late. But fortunately, they were wrong. Their talent was sufficient to keep me going.
So how is it enjoying life anew, like a two-year-old again?
Well, I quoted in my book this poem that my friend Raymond Carver wrote when, you know, he was told he had a very short time to live, and then he lived another 10 years. And during that 10 years, he did some of his best writing. And the poem is called Gravy, because he felt that every day was like gravy, you know. And I feel that. I feel like every day I wake up and I think, you know, I'm still here. It feels good.
And are you diminished by it at all?
I don't know about diminished. I lost a lot of weight, so I've diminished in that sense. I'm actually 55 pounds lighter than I used to be. Which is actually kind of an unintended benefit. But I think the only real diminishment is physical strength. I don't think my physical strength is back to what it used to be.
But your spirit and all of that, not dimmed.
No, that seems to be okay. One of the things I was very lucky about was that even though the knife penetrated my eye, it stopped just a millimeter or two short of my brain. And as a result, there's no brain injury, which means I can kind of go on being me.
And is life now divided into before and after that day? Is that the pivotal event now in your story?
Yes, I mean, it certainly at this moment, it feels like that. It feels like, I had to come back from near death and start again. It does feel like starting over.
And you've written a book, Knife, about the attack and your recovery. And can I say, Salman, it's an extraordinary book. It's so open. It's so honest. It's kind of raw and quite vulnerable in a way that people mightn't expect from you. But it is a very, very moving book about, I guess, life and death and lots of other things. One of the first things that struck me is your detailed recall of the attack, the build-up to it, that 27 seconds. Would you talk us through it?
Well, you know, some of it is recall and some of it is reconstructed from other people's testimony afterwards. But basically, I mean, I had come out on stage in this amphitheater space in Chautauqua in upstate Western New York to talk with my friend Henry Reese about a scheme for providing refuge in America for writers from elsewhere who needed safe spaces. And kind of ironically, you know, I was the one who didn't have the safe space that day. And we hadn't even begun the conversation. We had just come out and been introduced. And I saw this man come up from the audience, I mean, you know, leap up out of the audience and approach the stage. And I just to my right, there was a small flight of steps, like four steps up from the audience level to the stage level. And he just sort of sprinted up and came at me at high speed.
Did you have time to think in that moment?
Not really, you know. I mean, it was very fast and I was a little bewildered. And then he hit me very hard. And I mean, actually, initially I thought he just hit me. On the jaw. Felt like being punched very hard. And what I didn't realize was that he had a knife in his hand. And then I saw the blood coming down the front of my clothing. And then I fell down, you know, and then he was on top of me, stabbing away. And I mean, I think he got in 15 blows in 27 seconds. And then this extraordinary thing happened, which is first Henry, who was on stage with me, Henry Reese, and then people from the front row of the audience jumped up and dragged him off me and held him down. And if they hadn't done that, I would not be here talking to you.
Yeah, as you say in the book, you saw the best and the worst of humanity there. Did you think you were going to die when you were lying there?
Yeah, I did. I mean, absolutely, I did. I was quite clear about it. First of all, I was very badly injured. And secondly, I could see this enormous and increasing lake of blood all around me. And I thought, quite matter-of-factly, I thought, yeah, this is probably it, you know. And the sadness was to feel that I was dying in the company of strangers, you know, that nobody I loved or who loved me was anywhere within hundreds of miles. It was very clear that that's what was happening. And then, you know, mercifully, I managed to live long enough to get to the hospital by helicopter.
Any wisdom to bring back from the experience of near death? Did you have any blinding flash of anything? Did you find God in it or anything?
No, I didn't do any of that. The interesting thing is no blinding flash. You know, I mean, like, no, there was no supernatural element to what happened, even though that was about as close to death as you could get without dying. You know, but there was no tunnel of light. There was no feeling of lifting out of your body and moving to a different plane. There was no pearly gates. There was no gates of hell. You know, none of that.
Okay.
It was just me lying on the floor, bleeding to death.
The people on the other side clearly knew you were an atheist, is what we can take from that.
I guess they did. I guess they didn't reveal themselves, yes. Let's say.
Now, your wife, the poet Eliza Rachel Griffiths, is a huge character in the book. How did she hear, or how was she brought into this story now at this stage?
Well, she wasn't with me. She had stayed behind at home in New York City, waiting for me to do the gig and come back. And then, I mean, the attack happened at about 10:45 in the morning. And within a few minutes of that, her phone started going crazy. And the first person who called her was one of her close women friends who was crying. And Eliza didn't know what had happened. And her friend said, God, turn on the news. And then everybody in the world started calling her. And she was in a terrible state. And our literary agents talked to her and said, you've got to get up there as fast as possible. The problem is that Chautauqua by road is a very long way from New York. It's like 7 hours drive. And, you know, by train and so on, it's a long way away. And so she had to do something which we're not in the habit of doing, which is to hire a private plane, which cost a fortune. But, you know, there are moments in life when you don't count the cost. And our literary agents helped her find the plane, and she and her sister and her brother-in-law got in the plane and flew up to I'd been moved by that point from Chautauqua to Erie, Pennsylvania, which is where the trauma hospital was. So they flew to Erie. And when she arrived, there were a lot of security vehicles on the tarmac, and she was put in one of them to be brought to the hospital, and nobody would talk to her. And she thought, you know, oh, they're not talking to me because he's dead. She thought, I'm being taken to see my dead husband. And then, fortunately, that was wrong. I mean, by the time she arrived at the hospital, I mean, I was just coming out of surgery. I was still under the effect of anesthetic. So by the time I woke up, she was there, and I couldn't talk to her because I had a ventilator in my mouth.
And then she was there for the next weeks and months and everything. She was central to your recovery, Salman, was she?
Yeah, she was. She never left my side. I mean, you know, she wouldn't leave the hospital room to go to a hotel. She slept on a kind of what looked like incredibly uncomfortable bunkette to one side of the little hospital room. And she was just there every minute of every day and giving me strength and love and support and not letting me see, which is maybe the hardest thing, not letting me see her own grief. You know, when she needed to cry or scream or whatever, she did that not in the room. And she took over. You know, the nurses had to answer to her. The doctors had to answer to her. The surgeons had to answer to her. The FBI and the police had to answer to her. She just took charge of life. And you know, that continued after we left the trauma hospital into the rehab place and back home. I mean, she had to, because I was very weak for a very long time. So she had to do everything and did.
And the book is, among other things, I think a love letter to her very much. Yes. Do you believe more now or more strongly in the power of love since this happened?
I do, actually. And partly, I mean, to a large extent, it's because of her, because of Eliza, but also because of my children and my family. And beyond that, this enormous wave of sympathy and affection and solidarity that I felt coming in my direction from all around the world, you know. And when you're at your lowest ebb, that stuff is very strengthening. You know, it's very powerful, and it really lifts you up. And it did that for me. So thank you to everybody who sent me those wishes.
And the recovery was long and hard and a struggle. There's a striking, just a very simple thing in the book, that the big ambition at one stage was to make a fist. So did you have to fight back inch by inch to functionality?
Yes, because my left hand, for example, was completely immobile because the knife had penetrated it and had cut all the tendons and most of the nerves. I couldn't move anything. And it takes about 6 weeks. I mean, the tendons had been surgically repaired, but it takes about 6 weeks or so for them to be strong enough for you to even try to move your hand. And after that, then you have physiotherapists who encourage you to do so, et cetera. It took me probably 6 or 7 months of a lot of physiotherapy before I regained something like the normal use of my hand. Still not normal now, actually.
The primal wound for you must be the loss of your eye. What's that like for you?
Well, it's not good. It's not easy. And it kind of upsets me every day. But my mother had this kind of mantra that she would tell us as children when we objected to certain things. And she would say, what can't be cured must be endured. And we were brought up on that line, kind of tough love line. Mm-hmm. But that line has always stuck in my head. And I thought, well, okay, this definitely can't be cured. The eye is gone. So deal with it. Deal with it. And I'm trying. There are things you have to relearn, things as simple as pouring water from a bottle into a glass. What was happening in the beginning was that because of the loss of the kind of three-dimensionality of having two eyes, I would try and pour water and I would miss the glass and the water would go all over the table. By now I've kind of learned how to do it, but you have to learn everything again. You have to learn how to walk down the sidewalk without bumping into people because you can't see them coming at you from your right. So there's an enormous amount of just everyday life that has to be rethought and relearned.
And reading and writing?
Yeah, that too. I mean, what I'm finding is reading. I mean, I've always been a person who liked, you know, books rather than digital books. Mm-hmm. But now I find that I'm reading much more on an iPad for two reasons. One is that it's illuminated, so that makes it easier. And the other is I can alter the size of the type. And so I've suddenly entered this. I've entered the digital age thanks to this. Writing is not that easy when you're left. I mean, I have no feeling in three of the five fingers on my left hand, so that makes using a keyboard more complicated.
Yeah. So it can't flow out of you the way presumably it did.
Yeah, but you know, in the end, also it's amazing how the human mind adapts. You know, so when I began to write Knife, the physicality of the problem was getting in my way. Mm-hmm. But by the time I finished writing it, I'd kind of got used to it. You know, and this is now just, I mean, I now have to use a keyboard in a somewhat different way with my left hand. But, you know, again, you have to deal with it, so you deal with it.
Yeah, going back to what your mother said, acceptance, we talk a lot about acceptance now. It strikes me that acceptance is a thing you need massive reserves of now, is it?
Yeah, certainly in the ways that I've been describing, yes. But in, you know, in a lot of ways, I have regained a lot of my old self. You know, I mean, I'm kind of fully functional, except for the things we've just mentioned.
Okay.
I don't feel ill. I don't any longer need to be checked up by doctors every other day, which there was a period when that was happening. And a lot of the kind of health scares that there were have gone away, you know. I mean, there was a moment when there was a cancer scare, but that turned out to be false.
Yeah, you see, I think I'd be much angrier and more bitter than you are. What are your feelings towards your attacker now?
They're kind of nothing, really. I mean, I'm obviously not very well disposed towards him. But one of the things that actually puzzles me a little bit is that ever since the attack, the emotion that seems to have been missing from me is anger. I mean, initially, there was no time for anger because I was concentrating on survival. And now I feel that if I surrender to anger, which must be down there somewhere, it's a way of dragging me back into that past of 20 months ago. And at the point at which I'm really very strongly focused on trying to move forward into the rest of my life, you know? So anger doesn't help. It weighs you down, you know?
Yeah.
And it just, it's not constructive. It's not helpful to me, you know? And at the moment I'm focused on what's helpful to me. And he can, I mean, I just think he's in jail and that's good. That's the right place for him. And I feel that by writing this book, I've kind of written him out of my system, you know, and I don't really need to deal with him anymore.
And you conjure in the book imagined conversations with him. And I think you go back and forth a bit about whether you have any interest in meeting him or confronting him in a courtroom or anything.
Yeah, well, I think if there is a trial, which there will be, at the moment he's pleading not guilty, so there has to be a trial unless he changes that. But in that case, I mean, I've been told that I would be expected to testify. And that's okay. I don't mind. And there's nothing I would say that I haven't already said in this book.
And would you say anything to him directly?
I don't know if I'm allowed to. I mean, I think, yeah. You know, when you're in a witness box, you basically answer questions. You know, you answer questions of the prosecution, and then you answer questions under cross-examination. I don't think you're allowed to make speeches exactly.
You know? And do you have anything you want to say to him? Or, as you say, have you done it with the book now?
I think I've done it with the book. I think there are imagined things in the book that I imagine I would say to him if I were to meet him. And I think mainly the thing I would say to him is that, you know, the irony is that my life is okay and is improving all the time, whereas his life is wrecked. So the real thing he's done is to ruin his own life. And he's going to be in jail, I'm going to be free. And, you know, who wins that argument? Not him. I might want to say something of that sort to him.
In terms of moving on, you don't mention the kind of currently ubiquitous word trauma. But
yeah.
You went back to the prison, you went back to the scene of the crime. That felt like, in some way, trying to kind of free yourself from the trauma, was it?
It was certainly, it was something, the prison, the going to see the jail, that was a last minute decision. But the decision to go back to where it had happened was something that I felt from quite an early point. I mean, after I was sort of kind of in recovery and rehab, it was one of the things I thought I really at some point wanted to do, that when I was up and about again and strong enough, I wanted to go back to where it happened to show myself that I had recovered, you know, that in the place where it almost ended, I could show myself that I was fine and everything was continuing. I knew that that would be important for me.
And how was it for you?
Well, initially, my wife, Eliza, wasn't particularly keen on the idea, but then she could see it was important to me, so she came along with me. And it proved to be enormously important. I mean, I felt standing on the stage again in more or less the exact spot in which I'd been attacked. I literally felt as if somebody behind me was lifting a burden off my shoulders. You know, I just felt physically lighter. And I said to Eliza, I said, that's the only word I can think of. But what I feel a kind of lightness. And I felt that ever since. You know, so it was a very important part psychologically in the recovery.
You had a strange reaction when you stood outside the prison he's in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very kind of banal little prison in a small country town, Chautauqua. So it's a fairly sort of uninteresting cell block with walls around it with barbed wire on them. And I was in the car park, you know, because we just parked the car outside the prison to have a look at it. So I was in the car park and completely involuntarily, it seemed, my feet began dancing. It started jigging about.
Hmm.
And Eliza was a bit, and she was trying to take a picture of me. She said, would you please stop jumping up and down so I can get a picture of you? But I don't know, I just suddenly felt the urge to dance. I thought, I'm out here free in the car park and he's in there, not free, in jail. And that felt good.
Yeah, yeah. You won.
You know, it felt like a little victory.
So the background to this, and I mean, in a way, like, this is an awful story, but it's almost kind of farcical. When this happened, it was 33 years since the supreme leader of Iran had issued the fatwa against you for so-called blasphemy, or he ordered Muslims to kill you. That was over the satanic verses.
Yeah.
You had kind of moved on and gone back to a normal life, presumed it was all over, weren't afraid anymore, kind of, were you?
That's right. I mean, I moved to live in New York City in the beginning of the year 2000. So it's getting on for 25 years. And for the first 23 of those 25 years, I was really leading the ordinary life of a writer. You know, I was doing the kinds of things that writers do. I got a book tour, I was doing readings, I was doing lectures. I was, you know, leading a pretty average, ordinary life. And I really had come to think that that phase of my life when there was a high level of danger had passed, you know, because, I mean, even there had even been an agreement between the British and the Iranian government as a result of which the Iranian government kind of called the dogs off, you know. And so I felt, okay, that's the past. And so when this man came running at me, it actually felt like, I don't know, it felt like sort of time warp. It felt like he was emerging from the past to attack me in the present. And it was really quite a surprise.
And are you afraid again now?
No, I mean, I think one of the interesting things and useful things to know is that it doesn't seem as if he was part of any larger enterprise. I mean, put it like this, neither the police nor the FBI have arrested or anybody else in connection with this crime. So it does seem to have been a lone wolf attack. And so, you know, I just have to make sure nobody else has that opportunity.
Yeah. When you went back and started living your life, it's a kind of a sidebar in the book, but it is something that clearly annoyed you, was this portrayal that grew up of you as a kind of a party animal.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, everybody goes to parties occasionally, but when I go to parties, it becomes a news story. And it's kind of ridiculous because I don't even go to that many.
Yeah.
And I mean, I went to, when this book was about to be published, there was a book launch party. You know, it's kind of cocktail party for a couple of hours in a restaurant.
There was. I saw all the pictures, Salman. Graydon Carter drew it for you, didn't he?
There were like six news articles written about it.
Yes, yes.
it's just a book launch, you know?
I mean,
lots of writers have book launches. But when I have a book launch, it's proof of my being a party animal.
Yeah, that you're a trivial person.
Yeah, trivial. I've written 22 trivial books.
He goes to one party.
How did I write those books if I spent my life at parties?
Listen, I'm not sure if I'm on the right track with this. I want to ask you about something, and I don't even have the question framed, but you talk about a fictional story that you've never quite written in the book, right? And yeah. What I got from it is that, was there a sense that it can be foolish to be happy?
Well, yeah, I mean, what I was, this subject of happiness,
yeah,
writing about happiness, is something that's been in my head for really quite a long time, because it's quite hard to do, you know. If two people are happy and that's their story, there's kind of no story, you know. A lot of fiction arises out of conflict and drama, and if there's no conflict and no drama because everybody's holding hands and walking into the sunset, then there's kind of no story. So I was wondering and yet happiness is such an important part of human life. And I thought there must be a way of writing about it, which comes across interestingly on the page. So I was thinking about it and fooling around with it without fully having understood how. And then I did ask myself the question about, you know, when the world is in such a mess, and I mean, the world is in really quite a mess right now, is it even okay? Is it proper to be happy? Is it self-indulgent to be happy? Is it narcissistic? You know, when everything is exploding all around us, that was something I wanted to explore. And I wanted to explore it in this book as well as in my unwritten story, because, you know, in my private life, I actually have been happy now for, you know, for more than 7 years with the interruption of this murder attempt. But, you know, it felt like we were in a love story that somebody tried to turn into a murder story, and that we then had to work very hard to turn back into a love story. So the question of happiness is a question at near the heart of the book, I think, you know. And at the end, I talk about how, you know, how we've tried very hard to reconstruct our happiness, but it's not exactly what it was before, you know, that there's a kind of shadow in it. I describe it as being a wounded happiness. Maybe a wounded happiness is more interesting than a simple happiness, you know. Maybe there's more of a story there. I mean, I hope there is, because that's this book.
Yeah, no, there certainly is. So how has it changed you in general? Are you a softer person?
I've always been pretty soft, Brendan.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think I'm actually not a softer person. I think actually one of the things of the discovery I made about myself in this passage of time is that I'm much tougher than I thought I was. You know, I mean, it takes a degree of resilience, you know, to survive an attack like this. And I think I had no idea that I had that in me. You know, I think if you had told me before the attack happened that such and such is going to happen to you and how do you think you'll do, I would not have bet on myself to do very well. But it turned out that I did better than most of the doctors expected. And there was a point at which I asked my therapist, I said, tell me the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. And he listed them. And I said, but that's not happening to me. So why is it not happening to me? What's wrong with me that I'm not suffering those symptoms? And he said, well, it's just because you're a tough bastard. this is a technical term in psychotherapy. So I think I learned that I was that, you know? But I think one of the things that has happened with getting older is that I think I have become gentler as a person. I think that's been happening over the last, you know, many years. I think I'm at the age of almost 77. I think I'm a gentler character than I was, let's say, 50 years ago when I started writing.
Salman, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you again. And I mean it when I say that Knife is just such it's a terrific, terrific book. And I guess you've got it out of your system now and you can move on with the next thing. But Knife, Meditations After an Attempted Murder, is out now. Salman Rushdie, thank you so much.
Thank you. Really great to talk to you.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.